Welcome to another episode of Reboot with Dr. Arasi Maran. I'm your host, Dr. Arasi Maran. I'm an interventional cardiologist, but I use this podcast as a way to explore different aspects of health and disease and a way to reboot everyone's health in whichever path they choose to. In general, reboot can be anything. It can be a new diagnosis. It can be recovering from illness. It can be taking up a new hobby, resetting your mind. And there are different things which can inspire us and different things which can scare us into inspiration. And one such thing is lung cancer. And the diagnosis of lung cancer is usually looked at as a death sentence. But that landscape has changed and evolved. So to discuss about lung cancer and where we stand in 2025, I have with me a very dear friend, Dr. Nicole Tanner. Nicole and I started our internal medicine residency way back in 2004. And since then, we have been close friends. Our kids are of the similar age and, you know, we live in the same town. She is my sounding board and I'm her sounding board. We went out to each other and it's been a pleasure. It's been a source of joy to see Nicole's career grow and blossom to where it is. She currently is a professor of medicine at the Medical University of South Carolina, where she is the co-director of the Hollings Cancer Center Lung Cancer Screening Program. She also has a joint appointment as a staff physician and the director of the Lung Cancer Screening Program at the Ralph H. Johnson VA Medical Center. Nicole received an undergrad from University of Florida, medical degree from University of Miami, and also a Master's of Science in Clinical Research from the Medical University of South Carolina. Her research focuses on many aspects of lung cancer, including pulmonary nodule evaluation, diagnosis, staging, and early detection of cancer. Dr. Tanner has a long-standing interest in increasing uptake and ensuring adherence to the annual lung cancer screening. And she is involved with the Veterans Affairs Lung Cancer Precision Oncology Program that hopes to expand access to lung cancer screening. And she's involved in several of the lung cancer screening trials. And with that, Nicole, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks, Arasi. It's great to be here, and I appreciate all of the accolades. Just for your viewers, yeah, Arasi and I go way back to intern year, and it's been a great friendship, and I'm glad to participate in this. And hopefully you let everyone know a little bit about where we are with lung cancer today.
Yes. So let's start with the very basic, right? When people hear lung cancer, they immediately like, oh my God, you know, tears start follow. And then everyone thinks this is the end of my life. I may have 3 months to live, 6 months to live. How has this narrative changed over the past few years?
Sure. So I think, you know, I guess if we were going to take the big global look at lung cancer, you know, everybody knows pink and the pink ribbon for breast cancer and breast cancer awareness. But I think what very few people know is that lung cancer is actually more prevalent and more deadly. And so lung cancer kills more men and women than the next three cancers combined, prostate, colon, and breast. And so it's scary because it is so lethal. And I think there are a lot of concerns around that. But I think, you know, increasing awareness about lung cancer and its prevalence is really important, as well as encouraging folks to understand that it is not a death sentence. Certainly, how long someone lives after any cancer diagnosis is really dependent on the stage, right? And so prior to the advent of lung cancer screening, which I'm sure we will talk about here in a little bit, you know, the majority of patients who were diagnosed with lung cancer were diagnosed with locally advanced disease, so stage three or stage four disease. And we know that the more a cancer has spread, the harder it is to cure. And so the reason for that is that most people do not feel symptoms from a small lung cancer. They're not coughing up blood, they're not losing weight. And so because we were not screening prior to 2011, Most people came with advanced disease. We had very few things in our toolbox in order to help treat people. Chemotherapy drugs were just not very helpful in stage four disease, maybe extending the lifespan from 4 months to 9 months. That being said, the past decade to 15 years has really shown us an explosion of activities, including early detection, that is leading to a stage shift. So what we see now is that if we screen folks that are at risk, and we can talk about that, with a low-dose CT scan, there is actually a stage shift. So people are moving from stage four to stage one, which is what we want to see. Any good screening exam, whether it be mammography or colonoscopy, catches a cancer at an earlier stage when it can be cured, when the chance for cure is more likely. So the first point here, I guess, is that lung cancer is not a death sentence. We have a number of really great treatments, even in the cancers that have spread beyond a stage one. Stage one meaning a little tiny cancer, spread to the lymph nodes, which is, the body's drainage system where a lot of solid organ tumors like to spread. With those types of stages, we now have, every month there's a new publication coming out in New England Journal to talk about approaches that include chemotherapy and immunotherapy up front. And folks that were no longer surgical in the past are now having a complete response and undergoing surgery. We always say that we can't cure stage four disease. But now with all of these mutations that we find with testing, we have drugs that target mutations, and we're seeing patients live 5-10 years with stage four, which is something at the start of my career I never thought we would be able to say. So it's a really exciting time as a researcher, but it's even more rewarding as a clinician to have these greater, like, better conversations. I'm not dropping the hammer anymore. I'm trying to give hope. So it's great. And so that's how the landscape, to answer your first question, the landscape of lung cancer has changed.
So it's now almost become a very manageable chronic disease for a select few patients.
For some people. I mean, I don't want to, like, wear rose-colored glasses here, because, stage four disease is still stage four disease, and it all really is incumbent on any type of driver mutations and the availability of drugs. That being said, there's a number of clinical trials that are ongoing. There's just a lot more out there. Yeah. And I would just highlight that if anybody is happening to tune into this, that is someone who's been diagnosed with lung cancer, really the most important thing is to ensure that your particular tumor is being tested for mutations. And that's something that we're trying to drive home across the clinician space, as well as making patients aware that biomarker testing is really important.
Talk about, you briefly touched on this, the symptoms of lung cancer. I mean, it's usually weight loss, unexplained weight loss, prolonged chronic cough, coughing up blood. Anything else they should think of in lung cancer?
Yeah, so the issue with lung cancer is, as you've said, some of these symptoms are pretty nonspecific, right? So you might have a cough, you might have a little shortness of breath, but the people that tend to develop lung cancer, and again, we can talk about that, tend to have comorbid conditions like COPD or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or emphysema that make them feel short of breath. Or, if they're someone who has smoked cigarettes for a while, maybe they have a little bit of coronary artery disease and they're short of breath. So shortness of breath in and of itself isn't like a really sensitive, yeah. So it's hard, but I think unexplained weight loss for sure. If there's someone coughing up blood, those types of things in the right setting, and if you're at high risk, for example, older, aged 50 and older, and have smoked for a prolonged period of time, if you have a family history of lung cancer and you're having those symptoms, that's a reason to go get checked out for sure. It's just really hard to say. You talk to folks and they'll have no symptoms when they were diagnosed with lung cancer. Yeah.
So, let's talk about smoking. Is that the most biggest risk factor for development of lung cancer?
Yeah, it is. And so what we know is that 80% of people who develop lung cancer have smoked, right? And so I think, it's important to talk about the stigma around smoking. In fact, there was a statement that came out from the International Society for the Advancement and Staging of Lung Cancer that really pointed out that even we in the medical field can contribute to that stigma. We say smoker, you're a smoker, when in fact we have to try to think about it more like, oh, you're a person who smokes, you're someone who previously smoked. And that really resonates with patients when we don't think about it that way. And so when I'm talking with our critical care fellows or pulmonary fellows, is I really try to emphasize that because there's a lot of fatalism around people who smoke, right? They don't want to know. So they don't want to be screened, or they feel like, oh, I've done this to myself. This is my fault. It's a bad behavior. So when you think about lung cancer and lung cancer screening, really, this is the first time we're targeting a population, not because of age, but because of a behavior, right? And so there's a lot of stigma that goes around that. And so, yes, smoking is one of the major risk factors. But in the United States, the rate of smoking is declining, whereas in other countries, the rate of smoking is going up. And so we anticipate that kind of worldwide, there will be an increase in lung cancer in other underdeveloped or intermediately developed countries. But there are, 20% to 15 to 20% of people who developed lung cancer have never smoked. And the question is what happened? How did they get a lung cancer? And so there are other risk factors, for example, in Asia and China, exposure to wood burning stoves and particulate matter is a risk factor. Radon is another one that we think about. Exposures, actually, there was a recent publication to like a certain amount of pollution. So if you look across the United States, like in California, the air pollution and air quality has also been implicated. So yeah, the wildfires, all of these things are cogent. And then, there's certain, I think, family or genetic risk factors that we are starting to uncover. And, the typical, I've never smoked, but I developed lung cancer phenotype is, a younger woman, usually of Asian descent. The question is why, and we're seeing those, and it's a very real population, and that stigma comes after them too, right? Like they're someone who never smoked. There's no good screening test for people who never smoked, and so those types of things are being actively investigated on how we identify these patients.
Fantastic. Now let's talk about your favorite topic. Screening for lung cancer. This seems to be where the real revolution is happening. Because I remember, even when you were doing your pulmonary critical care fellowship, you were kind of talking more about interventional pulmonology, and we'll touch upon that a little bit. But it was kind of during your early, when you just started working, I was still in fellowship and you were working at that time. And I could see, the light bulb go off and you started talking about lung cancer screening. And so can you talk us through how lung cancer screening has evolved?
Yeah. Yes, the little light bulb went off. It was very exciting, and I'm glad to say I've made a career of it. But it's important, right? So the reason to do any screening test is to find something early, right? Breast cancer screening, colon cancer screening. And so the kind of tenets of any screening exam is that there are a large number of people who develop it, and there are a large number of people that die from it, and that it can be more curable when it's detected early. And so lung cancer meets all of those metrics. And so in 2011, the results of the National Lung Screening Trial were published, which was the largest at the time randomized trial looking at the reduction in lung cancer mortality from screening with a low-dose CT scan. So close to 40,000 patients in the United States were randomized to either have a chest x-ray versus a CT scan. And we know now that chest x-rays are not a good way to identify lung cancers early. And so a CT scan for those non-medical people tuning in is a simple picture of your lungs. You lay down on a table, go through an open tube, hold your breath, and it takes pictures of your lungs kind of like slicing through your body like a loaf of bread. And so what we found is that with LDCT or low-dose cancer screening, there was a 20% reduction in mortality from screening. And so the people that were participated in that trial were what was considered high risk. So at the trial, it was 55 to 74 had or were either actively smoking or previously smoked with a minimum of a 30-pack year history. And so once those results were out, the big question was, how do we implement? How do we do this? Because it's not just one scan. You have to come back every year. You have to understand that there's a chance, like a 1 in 4 chance, that you'll have a spot on the lung. And that does not necessarily mean cancer. You know, you talk about the anxiety, you tell someone, oh, you have a spot on your lung, they automatically go to, oh God, it's a lung cancer. So we have all these conversations up front so people understand that, you know, if you do have a nodule, we might just follow it. Most of the time we do just follow it. But would you be willing to have a biopsy if it was something that was more suspicious? Would you want to have surgery if this was something that we could take out? So these are the types of shared decision-making conversations that are novel or new for screening exams. You know, usually it's like, oh, you're 40 or 50, go get your mammogram, depending on which guidelines you look at. And so it's kind of evolved over time. And implementation and uptake of lung cancer screening has actually been low in the United States. If you look at the trajectory after breast cancer screening was approved, the numbers went up dramatically. The last evaluation of people that were actually eligible in the US that got screened showed that only 19% of the eligible population has been screened. So uptake has been really poor. And I think it kind of ties into what we talked about before, the fatalism around, you know, being somebody who smoked and not wanting to know. And also, I think there's been a kind of a slow lag in uptake with primary care providers to refer their patients, either because they can't identify who's eligible because the tobacco pack year history is not good, or somebody who previously smoked is not at the front of the mind. And there was a lot of like, oh, I have to do shared decision making. Like, what does that mean? And so these were all nuances. Also, most people that are, many of the people that are eligible are of lower, under lower socioeconomic status. So they're uninsured or underinsured. So they don't have access. And I could go on and on. So there's a lot of barriers to uptake, but it does work. The test works. You know, we're seeing other countries now start to implement lung screening globally. It's just and some places have really good success with uptake, and because they have national health programs and it's not you know, it's a covered service, et cetera.
So, Nicole, you just said this briefly, but I want you to expand on this. Smoking history, number of packs per year. Can you kind of define that and quantify that? Everybody thinks, oh, I smoke 5 cigarettes a day or 2 cigarettes a day. But how do you put that as, oh, this is a very strong smoking history, or?
Yeah, it's tough. So typically, the way we approach it is to say, on average, over the time that you've smoked, how many packs per day? And so they'll say, okay, well, I smoked half a pack a day, 10 cigarettes, right? But most people are like about a pack, which is 20 cigarettes. And so then you kind of do the duration, like when did you start? Oh, well, I was 20. When did you quit? Well, I'm still smoking and I'm 60. So that's 40 times one is 40 pack year. Similarly, if it was a half a pack, it'd be 40 times a half, which would be 20. It's very simple mathematics, but it's hard to collect that history accurately because many times, you know, the person that's checking the patient in will say, we'll do that, you know, tobacco history and say, okay, well, how much are you smoking? Oh, well, I'm down to 2 cigarettes a day. When in reality, on average, they were really smoking 2 packs a day for most of their life. So those types of nuances. And I should note that, you know, as we talk about screening, I mentioned the criteria for the National Lung Screening Trial, but, you know, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force has changed, or has adjusted recommendations. We're now in version 2.0. And so for those interested, the task force criteria for screening are anybody from the age 50 to 80 with a 20-pack year history, if they previously smoked, having quit within the past 15 years. And so those are the criteria now. I mean, if you look up other societies like the American Cancer Society, they've suggested that we do away with that years since quit because there are still people that develop lung cancer after they've quit beyond 15 years. But that might not necessarily be covered by the insurance providers. So most insurers and Medicare and Medicaid cover actually the CMS guidelines, which stops at 77. So just a food for thought. Certainly talk to your provider if you're interested in lung screening. And there's many resources online that can kind of take you through what the benefits and the potential risks are.
So, you know, but there's no minimal pack year history which puts you at a higher risk. Am I correct?
Well, so we've kind of dialed it down. It was first at 30, now it's 20 for the guidelines, you know, and so is a 10-pack year history. So there's all these really smart modelers that do this modeling exercise and look to see, you know, how many number needed to screen to prevent one lung cancer death. And so just because you're at high risk, there's a spectrum of risk, right? There's people on the lower end and then there's people on the higher end. And to that end, actually, now that you bring it up, we are investigating, and in some countries like Canada, And in the UK, they actually screen based on lung cancer risk. And so there are risk prediction models that take into factors other than age and smoking history. It will take in a personal history of cancer, things like your BMI, what else, all sorts of different things. And some of these risk calculators will actually factor in severity of competing causes of death, right? So there's this notion that we can screen you and find a cancer, but because smoking also contributes to things like heart disease,
yes,
right? Right, heart disease and COPD or, and emphysema, you have these other chronic illnesses that might be what gets you, right? So you might find a cancer, but that's not what's going to kill you. And so how to like put that all together in our head is really hard, which is why models are really great to do that. The problem with risk-based screening, at least in the United States, is that there's multiple inputs that have to be put into these calculators and clinicians just don't have time to do it. And so, you know, we're looking at ways to utilize and harness the electronic medical record to pull all of these data points in and spit out a number so that the clinician doesn't have to, and in real time, say, this is someone who is high risk, but high benefit. You should offer screening. So those types of things. So, you know, the bare bones basics is a 20 pack year. I can't tell you if a 10 pack year, you know, some people, especially blacks tend to smoke for like a smaller amount, but for a longer duration. And sometimes it's actually the duration of smoking, not the amount, that contributes to lung cancer risk. So all of these different things that people are thinking about really hard.
I can't tell you the number of patients who come to my office because they had a low dose CT scan and the incidental coronary artery calcium was obtained, and they come to me and now they're like, oh my God, I went for one thing and now there's another diagnosis. And talking them through that, just because you have coronary artery calcium does not mean you're going to have a heart attack. And that actually is kind of, I think lots of AI tools are coming into place to risk stratify these patients. And I'm sure there will be very soon an AI-based model which can predict your coronary artery disease history risk and also your lung cancer risk with that single low-dose CT scan. And maybe even predictive AI could come into place as well.
Well, it's funny that you should mention that. And so sorry about all of the coronary artery calcifications that we send your way. It's keeping you in business. But I would say, you know, the incidental findings, you know, thyroid nodules, coronary calcifications, aortic aneurysms. I mean, we find so many things. And that is kind of the bane of the lung cancer screening coordinator's existence, is all these incidental findings. And what do you do? I think as it relates to coronary artery calcifications or CAC, you know, there are ways for the radiologist to potentially segment, although we can't do that. What is it? The Agstron scoring. We can't do that bit, but you can kind of look at the severity. But to the AI piece, that's definitely an area of active research. And as it relates to lung cancer risk, there was an AI algorithm called Sybil that was developed out of MIT, utilizing data sets from the National Lung Screening Trial, Mass General, and then a huge Taiwanese screened cohort. And it's kind of a black box AI. We don't really know what goes into it, but it can take a single baseline scan, no risk factors, no age, no nothing, no nothing. Sorry, no nothing doesn't sound good, but without any clinical factors, and predict that person's risk for developing lung cancer with a pretty good receiver operating curve at 2 years and 3 years. It kind of fizzles out. Now, we've been trying to replicate that in other populations and not quite there yet. But, you know, my personal hope is that we'll get there. And this is and the thing about Sybil is it's something that runs in the background while the radiologist is doing the interpretation. So it can just put up that risk score. And you can see how that might be helpful, right? If somebody has a baseline scan, even if there isn't a nodule, mind you, Sybil did better when there was a nodule. But even if there isn't a nodule, you know, those scans that are normal, that might, you know, if you had a high Sybil score, you might tell that patient and they'll be more willing to come back, because adherence is the other part of this. You can't just do one scan and done. They have to come back every single year. Otherwise, you're losing the efficacy and the mortality benefit. So there's that piece. But I do think that AI would be helpful for a lot of stuff, and we're working on it. And when I say we, I mean the collective we.
No, but I think you're absolutely right. But, you know, even if the Sybil score says this is a normal scan, but this patient has high risk of cancer, how do we use that information? What do you do? I mean, you know, unless it gives a specific location, do you, I mean, it's going to we are such in a lull or in a very progressive moving target phase that what we are, the way we practice medicine today can be completely different, probably in 1 to 2 years with all these AI tools coming in. So, you know, you talked about yearly screening. Okay. So for example, colonoscopy and even in mammography, right? If you have X number of clean mammograms, you don't need to do it yearly. You can go to 2 years. The same way with colonoscopy, if you've had a completely clean colon, you can go to 5 years or something like that, depending on other risk factors. Is there some sort of a change in lung cancer screening?
Not yet. So I will say that the NELSON trial, which was the European equivalent to the NLST or the National Lung Screening Trial, that also showed a mortality benefit, did have a subset that did every 2 years and they found more advanced cancers. So we're not ready to pull the trigger on, reducing that to every 2 years. It might be, as you said, that we'll be able to incorporate some type of AI algorithm that could then say, okay, well, you're at lower risk, and so maybe you need to come back in 2 years, but that has yet to be tested, validated, proven. Yeah.
Yeah. So fantastic. So now let's shift on to the other aspect of your career, which is the interventional pulmonology. I remember, you know, we had a great mentor, Dr. Gerard Silvestri, and he just came back from a sabbatical in London, right, when we both started our internship after his interventional pulmonology training. And he tried his best to convince me to do interventional pulmonology, but I'm very happy where I am. But nevertheless, that's a very new, young field, which has come into it. How does interventional pulmonology and lung cancer or evaluation of a lung nodule come together?
Sure. So yeah, interventional pulmonary or IP is definitely a budding field. I would say that when I trained, there was not yet formal fellowship programs. So some of us are grandfathered in. They do now have an interventional pulmonary board. And I think next year, or maybe it's this year, there'll be a full and formal AA, the American Board of Internal Medicine, like sanctioned. Yeah. Yeah, for interventional, because it wasn't for a while. So it's just kind of like some of these programs that we're developing at kind of the larger academic, institutions. And so what does a regular pulmonologist do? Obviously, we treat pulmonary disease. We're trained to do some procedures, including bronchoscopy, which is similar to colonoscopy, airways inspections, and the like. The role of the pulmonologist as it relates to lung cancer diagnostics has changed over the past, I would say, 20 years, when that is with the staging for lung cancer. And so I talked a little bit about the beginning, but when you have a lung cancer, it's really important to know the stage because that's what determines the treatment. And we have these lymph nodes that sit along our windpipe and the bronchial trees that are the areas of drainage. And so for those non-medical people, your lymphatic system is there to fight infection. When you have a sore throat, you might notice a swollen node or a gland. That's that lymph node doing its job. The army's gearing up to fight infection. While you can have cancers of the lymph node, you can also have solid organ tumors that spread to the lymph nodes. So colon cancers, breast cancers, lung cancers. And so it's really critical to know what the spread is like. And so prior to the advent of endobronchial ultrasound, we as pulmonologists were doing blind biopsies of these lymph nodes along the windpipe.
So let's break that down before you go into. So when you say blind biopsies, you put a tube into the windpipe and then just poke a needle.
You use anatomical landmarks. Yeah.
Yes.
Landmarks. Right. And so if the lymph node's like huge below it, no big deal. But if it's a small lymph node, so what I'm saying is it really wasn't a great way to stage the mediastinum. And we relied on our surgical colleagues to take the patients back to the operating room and do what's called the mediastinoscopy, where they go in and sample all of the lymph nodes to prove that there hasn't been spread prior to taking out the tumor. So, EBUS or endobronchial ultrasound was developed, and basically it's a new scope, not a new scope. It's been around for decades now, but the scope has an ultrasound at the tip. And so, when you're doing an echo of the heart, you put the ultrasound on the chest and see the heart on the other side. This is a miniature ultrasound. And so we, the pulmonologists, are able to put the ultrasound at the tip against the wall of the windpipe and see the lymph node on the other side, and then in real time send a wire with a little needle through the channel of the scope and take a biopsy of the lymph node. And so that was what was game changing from pulmonary. And I would argue that EBUS is something that every pulmonologist should be able to do. It does not need to sit in the hands of interventional pulmonary. And that's the type of training we aim to do, because it is part of the guidelines that we should have mediastinal staging done by EBUS or EUS, which is the esophageal ultrasound side of things. So there's that, and there have been many studies that show that the sensitivity and specificity are just great, right? And so that's kind of what changed the role of the pulmonologist in lung cancer, really. And so then here comes the interventional pulmonary field. And so what is it that they do that maybe your general community pulmonologist doesn't do? They have the opportunity, or the skill set to do something called rigid bronchoscopy, which is essentially like swallowing a sword. Yeah, right down there, right. And that allows for, you know, doing procedures when there is an endobronchial tumor, which is a tumor inside the airway. And, you know, if there's a narrowing of the airway, we can put stents in, we can debride tumor, debulk tumor, et cetera, et cetera. And so that there's that. They also are able to do thoracoscopy, which is where they put a camera into the pleural space, which is the lining around the lung, to take a look at the lining of the lung. And this is almost surgical, if you will. We do advanced pleural procedures, like putting indwelling pleural catheters in for folks that have an effusion, which is fluid around the lung, and they need to drain it at home. So those types of things. But I would say that, you know, now IP is really integrated into lung cancer in general, simply because you take care of those advanced airways things, which we're seeing less and less of. But also the ability to stage the mediastinum. And then there's been this new advent of the robots, right? So we have robotic bronchoscopy, which allows us to get to these very small nodules out in the periphery. So if you think about your airways as the trunk of a tree and you finally get to the twigs, eventually the diameter of the airway is going to be so small you can't get the scope, because it doesn't go out that far and you can't hold it as a human that far. Well, with robotic bronchoscopy, it's kind of a mother and daughter. We've got like the larger scope, and then it's kind of like Alien. The little one comes out. Yeah. Yeah. So we're doing more, and it's costing more as far as tools go. Like, these are really big pieces of capital equipment. And then there's the integration of things like cone beam, where you do a spin and you can see where you're at, so that you can do the biopsy and readjust. And the diagnostic yield is improving with these types of techniques. That being said, we know that a CT-guided biopsy has a diagnostic yield about 94%. But there was a recent trial that was just published called the Reliant trial. Like, this is published in the Veritas trial was the other one that was just published in the New England Journal like last week. That looked at a comparison between CT-guided biopsy and bronchoscopy, and the diagnostic yields were very similar, and the risk profile was better with bronchoscopy. So I think there's more to come on that. Now we kind of have some evidence that we as interventional pulmonologists can get the diagnosis.
Fantastic. I mean, it's amazing. I think, you know, robotics is coming everywhere, and AI and robotics, and as I said, by another five, back before you and I retire, the way we practice medicine is definitely going to take another turn. So, you know, we talked about the risk factor of smoking. How has the smoking cessation therapies evolved? Has there been any changes at all?
Yeah, so it's so tough, right? Because you think that this is a teachable moment, right? You have this captive audience at the time of screening, right? You're somebody that smokes, you're worried, you're getting your CT scan. But I would say that, you know, getting a scan is not really a teachable moment. A teachable moment is like, oh my God, I just had a heart attack and died, and Dr. Marin brought me back to life, and so now I should quit smoking. Like, that is a teachable moment. It's like a life-changing event. I would argue that a CT scan isn't, but we still try, right? So we try. And integrating tobacco treatment into lung screening is a very important thing. And so what are the treatments? Well, people will say, oh, I went cold turkey. We know that doesn't work. The best treatment, the best treatment that we have is a combination, right? So you want meds and you want to talk to someone, right? And so the best medication we have is varenicline, which is Chantix, which acts on a neuroreceptor in your brain that makes you want to have a cigarette and kind of quashes that desire. there was previously a black box warning, but that's since been removed. There was a huge trial, I believe it was called the Eagles trial, that pointed out that people with mental health disorders, suicide risk, homicidal risk, all that stuff, they did not have any bad outcomes using Chantix. So Chantix is pretty well tolerated, and the biggest side effect is vivid dreams. So I always counsel someone that, you might start dreaming in Technicolor, but it's very effective. So I would say that that's like one change. But that coupled with talking to a tobacco cessation person along the way is important, because it's not just like a one-time thing. Like, smoking cessation is a journey. It's like falling off the wagon. Think about people that are alcoholics, right? Like, you have to have that support. And I think it's really important for us to validate that this is not their fault. Like, this is not your fault. This is highly addictive. I mean, RC, you see people at the VA, as do I, and they'll tell me they quit every substance, like all the hard drugs, all the alcohol, but they cannot stop the cigarettes. It's so tough.
I mean, nicotine addiction is one of the toughest addictions, and you talked about a heart attack, and there are people getting repeated heart attacks and still not able to quit smoking. So it's not it's a the best thing we can advise people is don't start smoking.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. And that gets into the whole vaping thing, right, in younger kids, but that's for another day.
Oh, that I think I can just talk about vaping. I'm so angry. How did we allow this as a medical community to, vaping to take on so much? So let's talk about.
In our country, it didn't happen in other countries.
I mean, I think Europe is very closely following US, unfortunately, in that path. Because it's again marketing, and they just say, oh, it's healthier than smoking. And I'm like, no, in which world, in which parallel universe is vaping better than smoking? Yes.
A ton of nicotine into that little pod. It's way more addictive.
Yes. So let's talk about secondary. Yes, because it's so annoying. It is absolutely annoying, right? And the colorful flavors and the packaging, and they're selling it to kids. It's we shouldn't. I feel all the entire medical community to needs to protest and ban the vaping industry altogether.
Yeah, I have a recommendation for another speaker that could come onto this podcast and you could delve into that much more.
Fantastic. I love that. Let's talk about secondary smoking, because sometimes, people are, they don't smoke, but people around them are smoking. How dangerous is that for lung cancer?
So secondhand smoke exposure. Yeah, so I should have mentioned that before. That was my neglect there. But yeah, certainly there are many people that worked. Back in the day, people could smoke in the office. So you'll hear about women that were, running the front desk. I was in an office with all these people that smoked. Even though I personally didn't smoke, bartenders before the smoking bans, flight attendants before the smoking bans. These are things that we don't commonly think about, but certainly, and you'll hear, oh, well, when I was growing up for 18 years, I lived in the house. Both my parents smoked inside. It's just really hard to quantify the amount. And it is definitely a risk factor, but when people are like, well, shouldn't I be screened because I have secondhand smoke exposure? That's a more nuanced conversation, because it's not approved in the guidelines, right? And so it always comes down to who's going to reimburse for the scan, and are we doing more harm than good? And really, what is your personal risk for developing cancer based on that profile? So it's difficult, but yes, certainly a risk factor.
Just to be even more picky on this topic, when we talk about smoking, we are talking about cigarette smoking, cigar smoking, pipes smoking, chewing tobacco, vaping nicotine. Am I missing any other inhalatory forms of tobacco-related products here?
No, and chewing tobacco has its own issues with like head and neck cancers, right? Like mouth cancers, tongue cancers, all that stuff. But yeah, and then it's just so hard to quantify when someone smokes cigars and they're smoking a cigar, a day. Again, it's hard for me to wiggle that into the guidelines for screening, honestly. So right now, as it stands, the recommendation for lung screening, anyways, is specific to combustible tobacco cigarettes, yeah.
So Nicole, this has been absolutely enlightening. Before we wrap up, okay, what advice would you like to give to someone who is smoking casually, who's in their 40s and 50s?
Yeah, well, so I would say that the health benefits that you stand to gain from being able to quit are enormous, right? It's beyond cancer, beyond lung cancer, but tobacco smoking has also been associated with bladder cancers and head and neck cancers, breast cancer, you name it. Not to mention coronary artery disease, that's Dr. Marin's area, and certainly stroke, right? And so the benefit that you have for your total body well-being would be to stop smoking. And we understand that it's really addictive and it's not your fault. And there are resources out there. Most insurers will cover a nicotine replacement and varenicline and Wellbutrin. And just, really, it has to start within. It's a journey. And so that would be what I would say is, improve your overall well-being and longevity. There's certainly someone in your life that you have to live for, whether it be a child or a grandchild. And so, sometimes that can be motivational. And there are many, many resources. You just have to utilize them. And we are here in the medical community, to support you on that journey.
Well, with that, Nicole, thank you so much for joining us and for all this incredible work you're doing for our community, for the greater global network with your million different research projects, which are happening all around the country. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me, RSC.
Yes. And thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of Reboot with Dr. Arsi Marin. Remember, medicine is constantly evolving, treatments are improving, and there's always reason for hope, and there's always a very good reason to reboot your life. With that, until next time, this is Dr. Arsi Marin reminding you that every day is a chance to reboot your health journey. Take care. Thank you so much for listening. If you found us valuable, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any of your favorite podcast app. And also, please consider leaving us a rating or a review, as that helps others find the podcast too. I hope you have a great week ahead.